Good evening, folks. This is Radio Edu Talk. My name's John Johnson. I'm sitting in a rather dull Glasgow this evening, and I'm really pleased to be joined by Lorna M. Campbell, who is going to talk to us a wee bit about open education and hopefully open Scotland. I think this is an area that will be really interesting. I believe I'm fascinated and interested in it with a very shallow knowledge, so I'm hoping to expand that tonight. Lorna, could you maybe start off by just giving us a bit of background on where you've come from, what you do, and that sort of general thing?
Yeah, sure, John, and thanks very much for inviting me along to speak tonight. I'm also sitting in a rather dull Glasgow tonight, but a different bit of Glasgow. I'm originally from the Western Isles. I was born and brought up in Stornoway. And like a lot of people from the Western Isles, I left the island to go to university. And I actually studied archaeology at Glasgow University. So really what I am is an archaeologist. I kind of became a learning technologist by default. I sort of eventually drifted into education technology. And I've been working in educational technology since about 1997. And I've always had an interest in the use of online resources to facilitate teaching and learning. And it's really through those channels that I got interested in open education. Over the years, I've worked on quite a wide range of education technology projects, but since 2001, I've worked for an organisation called CETUS. CETUS is a Centre for Education Technology, Interoperability and Standards, and we're a national UK technology advisory centre, and we provide strategic, technical and pedagogical advice on education technology and standards to funding bodies, standards agencies, government institutions and commercial partners. We traditionally work mostly with the higher education sector. We do some work with the further education sector, but a lot of what we do is applicable to the education sector more widely. And one of the initiatives that I'll be talking about later on tonight, the Open Scotland Initiative, is something that we hope is going to be of relevance and of interest, and which will engage schools, colleges and universities right across Scotland. So that's just a little bit about how I've kind of come from, you know, into education technology to where I am today.
Thanks very much, Lorna. I mean, it's a fascinating area, and it sounds as if you've had a interesting trip to get where you are. Can we maybe start off by talking about this word open? I would say that there's a lot of people of my sort of, I wouldn't say generation, because a lot of them were younger than me, that stumbled into online stuff as teachers around 2000, mid-2000s, and have this vague notion about Creative Commons and sharing, that, you know, all committed to sharing in the open. But open can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's in some senses, open is quite a contentious word. It's certainly a contended word in many areas, and depending on your perspective, it can have many different meanings. Openness can refer to the open source software movement, for example, the open access movement, which is about open access to scholarly works and peer-reviewed journals. You've got open educational resources, the open badges movement, and then, of course, there's the massive open online courses or MOOCs. And in all these different spaces, open means something quite different. Sometimes open is just a synonym for free. And that's kind of the way the word open is used in MOOCs. It's really something that you can receive without payment. In other spaces, open is much more about freedom. Sometimes people make the distinction between free as in beer and free as in speech, and the difference between open and libre, whereas libre is more about freedom. And that's the sense of openness in open educational resources. So the way open is used in that context is it refers to something that you can take for free, but it's also open in that you can change it, you can reuse it, you can alter it, you can turn it into something different. So you've got much more ability to change and reuse it, and you can't, you generally can't do that with the type of open that you find in massive open online courses. So, and again, if you look at open source software, they tend to have a very strict definition of what they mean by openness. But I think probably the most useful way to view openness is that it's a continuum, and different initiatives will be on different sort of places on that continuum, depending on their maturity, depending on how open they want to be, how open they can be, because, you know, it's great to be able to sort of say, oh, well, everything should be open. But of course, you know, that's not possible. There are always some things that need to be kept private or confidential. So I certainly think that it's useful to look at openness more as a continuum, and also as a continuum that can evolve, rather than, you know, sticking with one fixed definition.
That sounds great, because I think I've got a kind of, I suppose, vague, hippy-dippy notion of, you know, openness, which is probably shared and comes out of, say, a knowledge of Creative Commons, for instance, where I suppose, again, there is this continuum.
Yes, yeah.
Is there maybe a sort of definition of an open education resource that means if it's if it fits that bill, it is something that can be reused? And is there anything in it in the same way as the sort of share alike part of Creative Commons?
There are lots of, if you Google OER definition, you'll find lots of different definitions. I've got one here, which is the UNESCO definition of OER. And the term open educational resource, or OER, was actually coined by UNESCO in 2002. So whenever I'm asked for a standard definition of OER, I tend to fall back on the UNESCO definition. And they define OER as teaching, learning and research materials in any medium, digital or otherwise, that reside in the public domain or have been released under an open license that permits no cost access, use, adaptation and redistribution by others with no or limited restrictions. And I think one of the things that's quite nice about that definition is that it hits all the different aspects of openness. So it mentions residing in the public domain, so you must be able to get to these resources without any impediment. It mentions open license. It mentions no cost access, so that's a free bit, the free as in beer. And it mentions the ability to use, adapt and redistribute either with no restrictions or with limited restrictions. And as you've already said, Creative Commons offers a number of different licenses which are more or less restrictive depending on the resources that they're applied to. So I think that's, I mean, it's a bit of a wordy definition, but I quite like it because it does manage to encapsulate all these different aspects of openness.
Yeah, and just before we kind of go on, Laura, thanks, is can I just mention, because I usually forget to do this, if you're out there listening to the live show, you can get in touch with us by using the hashtag edutalk. If you get any questions for Laura, please do that. I'll try and keep an eye on the Twitter stream. The show will, of course, be archived and be available on Radio Edutalk. That's edutalk.cc in the next few days. And of course, you can continue the conversation with any time with Lorna, whose Twitter name is at Lorna M Campbell with a P. So we can get in touch, tweet in, whatever you like, and join in this hopefully open conversation.
Yes, please do.
In some definition of openness. And I don't know if you maybe could give people a sort of history of, and I think you're, as you said earlier, coming from a sort of tertiary level education background, where, to my mind, traditionally it was quite hard to get hold of material that was published, there was usually cost attached.
Yes. Yep.
And how that is maybe starting to move, and where that idea came from, and things like that.
Yep. I mean, it's certainly true that I think open education, and particularly OER, has been driven by the higher education sector globally. But it's certainly having a huge impact in other sectors. So as I mentioned, the term OER was originally coined by UNESCO in 2002, which is, you know, quite a long time ago now.
Yeah, before.
Especially in education technology terms.
Yeah.
And 2002 was also the same year that Creative Commons was launched and released their first license. And it was also the year that MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, launched their open courseware initiative. And what MIT did was they decided to put all their teaching materials online so that anyone could access them entirely free of charge. When this was announced, I think it's fair to say that the announcement was met with some scepticism. Mm. Some people sort of said, oh, there must be a catch. There's no way that MIT would give away all this stuff. I think other people thought they'd gone mad because, you know, MIT is one of the most prestigious higher education institutions in America. You know, why would they give all this stuff away? But of course, what MIT realized was that they were giving away just the content. They weren't giving away their teaching expertise. They weren't giving away the experience of going to MIT. They weren't giving away degrees. All they were doing was opening access to their content. And that actually got them a huge amount of publicity globally. And that was really, these three developments in 2002, I think, were perhaps the beginnings of the open education movement. And there were other sort of developments subsequent to that. Some of the other main points it's worth mentioning. Several years later, in 2006, the Open University in the UK launched the Open Learn initiative, and that was very similar to MIT's open courseware. In 2006, the OU started opening access to a lot of their content, and all that material is still there and still freely and openly available. Then the following year, something called the Cape Town Declaration came about, and that was a declaration about open access, open education and open education resources, which resulted from a meeting in Cape Town held by the Shuttleworth Foundation. And I think that was maybe one of the first sort of more sort of ideological statements about open education. And I think, you know, that one of the things that is quite interesting there is you're starting to see a sort of the development of a sort of ideology, and also an ideology that draws together openness from different areas of education. So that was 2007. 2008 was the first year that the term MOOC was coined, or Massive Open Online Course, and the term, I believe, was coined by Dave Cormier in response to a course that Stephen Downes and George Siemens of Athabasca launched called Connectivism and Connective Knowledge. And this was a free online course. Well, it was actually a course that they ran in Athabasca, but they opened access to it so other people could join in. And that was really the first MOOC. There's a bit of a misconception that MOOCs were invented by the Americans, and the Canadians get very upset about that, because it was they maintain that MOOCs were invented in Canada, and they will prove it to you.
Yeah.
So that was 2008. In 2009, there were some interesting developments in the UK. The Higher Education Funding Council for England announced that they were going to put a massive amount of money, over £10 million over the course of 3 years, into what became the UK OER programme. That programme was managed by JISC, the Joint Information Systems Committee, and the Higher Education Academy. And CETUS, the organisation I work for, were one of the services that supported that programme. And what that programme aimed to do was to release existing higher education content under open licence, the metaphor that we used at the time was turning on a tap. It was just about getting lots of content out there. And we just said, put your material anywhere you want, put it on websites, on blogs and digital repositories, on, you know, your university website. Mm-hmm. We don't care, just get it out there with an open license. But there was another aim to that programme as well, which was really about raising awareness of open education and starting to change practice within higher education in England. Now, as I said, the funding for this initiative came from HEFCE, the Higher Education Funding Council for England. So only English universities were allowed to bid for that money. Further education institutions couldn't participate, and Scottish institutions couldn't participate. They were, of course, able to benefit from the resources produced by UKOER, but they didn't actually participate in the projects. So I certainly felt that I think there's less awareness of open education in Scottish higher education than there perhaps in England. So that programme ran for 3 years to 2012. And 2012 is the year that, if you read the press, will tell you it was the year of the MOOC. And 2012 was the year that a whole range of commercial MOOC platforms started up in the US, companies like Udacity and Coursera. Another launch that year was edX. edX is slightly different because while Udacity and Coursera are commercial companies, edX is actually a foundation which was launched by Harvard and MIT, so it's a slightly different body. And in 2012, the University of Edinburgh became the first university in the UK to join Coursera. So it was all happening in terms of MOOCs in 2012. And to some extent, open education and open education resources rather fell off the radar a bit because people were so obsessed with this new MOOC thing. But it wasn't all, you know, they weren't completely left behind because UNESCO and the Commonwealth of Learning in 2012, they released what's now known as the Paris OER Declaration. And this is basically a declaration aimed at governments, about encouraging governments to support the creation and the use of open educational resources in education. And that was a very important point in the development of the OER movement. And 2012 was also the year that the first MOOC launched in the UK. The Open University announced the launch of FutureLearn. So there's been, I think, since then, you know, the MOOCs have gone in the very traditional hype cycle. There's been a bit of a backlash since then, and I think there's, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about how open MOOCs really are and who do they really benefit when they are. They're very, very focused on higher education and, you know, well, what about benefits for, you know, college learners, for adult learners? You know, what can we learn for the school sector? So that's just a very sort of, you know, brief run through sort of potted history.
I think that was a brilliant run through. I really hope that you had notes there, because that seems incredibly detailed to me and gives us a really good picture of how this the OER movement developed here. We could just take that wee bit of audio and use it as a great introduction to thinking about this. So just on the start, thanks very much about that, for that.
No problem.
A few things that come out of that is interesting to me is that presumably there's a perceived benefit of being open, and different people, I mean, people, educators who are acting individually on the internet and publishing stuff, say in a blog or something, would say that the benefit of being open is you get help from other people. It's just share the workload and people fix things for you and the likes. It sounds like there's a good push from the institutions themselves, or some of the institutions themselves, there's also the government are right behind this.
Well, certainly in some areas, yes. I mean, one of the things that was quite interesting about the very first phase of the UK OER programme was that there were three different strands of the programme. One was to encourage subject consortia to get together. One was aimed at individual institutions and one was aimed at individual educators. So just, you know, single teachers could apply for funding to release their own teaching materials. And I think you're right. There are all kinds of benefits to opening, to all kinds of aspects of openness. I think we can learn a lot ourselves by opening our practice and by opening the materials that we use. I think that cost saving is sometimes held up as one benefit of openness, but I think it's important to realise that open and free are not necessarily the same thing. And I think it's relevant that most of the big open education initiatives have been funded either by foundations such as the Gates Foundation or the Hewlett Foundation in the US, or by government bodies such as HEFCE in England, or by individual institutions such as MIT or the Open University. So openness does come at a cost, but I think the benefits that you get from openness are huge. And I certainly feel that there's an aspect to openness that's very important in education. I think, you know, education is a fundamental human right. And I think we all need to lower the barriers to education right across the world at every level. And I think we need to make sure that everyone has access to the best quality education available to them. And I think the greater access that we have to shared educational content will help that. Of course, content's not the only thing. We still need, the most important thing is passionate, talented teachers. But it does help if there is a body of freely available content there as well.
It's quite interesting that you go to passionate teachers, because one of the interesting things, I suppose, about learning in the open is this idea that you can learn collectively with other people, I think.
Absolutely.
And we've referred to MOOCs several times, and as I've been in a few MOOCs for varying lengths of time, from 30 seconds to 6 weeks. And one of the things, I mean, in some of them there is quite a strong engagement from the leaders, and others it's really the engagement with other learners. So with a sort of set of resources and some sort of agreed structure, you can actually learn quite a lot.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And I think there's real opportunities as well for, developing communities as well. I feel like, you know, at this point I should hold my hand up and sort of say I tend not to do MOOCs purely because of pressure of time and nothing else. But I'm very, very engaged in open education communities, both within the UK and globally. And, you know, I converse with a wide range of peers, normally through Twitter, and it's kind of like that's where my open community resides, and it's through these interactions that I develop my own practice within education, because I work from home here in Glasgow. You know, I sit in my front room, and you know that's where I work, and but it's almost like my office space, you know, is Twitter. It's a whole of the World Wide Web. And I think it's that aspect of openness is very, very important. And I think it's, you know, coming from the kind of community where I grew up in the Western Isles, I think, and, you know, thinking of small scattered schools all over the Highlands and Islands, I think that ability to connect with other teachers and other learners, whether it's, you know, on the next island down or the other side of the world, doesn't really matter. I think it's that ability to share experiences is really important.
And that kind of probably leads us nicely into another thought about this openness. As I say, it seems to be, I would have said, becoming well established in tertiary education.
Yes, yeah.
There are, I think, plenty of people who are working in the open in primary and secondary education, but maybe bringing the benefits down to the learners and young learners is perhaps a challenge, or being seen as a risk. I don't know if you've thought anything around that.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I mean, like I said, I mean, my I've worked most of my life in higher education, but one of the things that is very interesting about the open education space is that it brings together people from different education sectors, and there is a lot of really good work going on in the school sector. And I think there are challenges to opening up education for school children, because obviously you do have to be that bit more careful about sharing information, obviously. But there are some really interesting initiatives, and one that I didn't mention when I was going through my, the potted history of open education was in 2009. There was an initiative set up called OER for Schools, and in actual fact, one of the areas where open educational resources have really sort of taken off in the school sector is in sub-Saharan Africa. And I must admit, it's not an initiative I know quite a lot of, I know a great deal about, but I do know that I think in Africa, that's one area where they have really made a big effort to open access to educational resources for the school sector. And I recently heard about an interesting initiative in Poland to develop open textbooks for schools as well. That's another aspect that I didn't mention earlier on. The development of open textbooks also has quite a lot of potential. So I think there's a lot that, a huge amount that the school sector could benefit from by not just having more access to educational resources, but also by opening that educational practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to some extent, the Curriculum for Excellence is in some ways very well suited to this approach to education. And I think that I can imagine it would be very, very beneficial to have shared open resources within the Curriculum for Excellence. And one area in particular where I think that would be really valuable is at the sort of transition phase, the articulation phase between school and college or school and higher education. There's a lot of interest in how more openness could help to ease that transition for learners.
Yeah, I mean, and I think because we're in transition as teachers ourselves from, in my sector, from the 5-14 curriculum and into Curriculum for Excellence, there's a lot of new things. There's mm-hmm. a great advantage in sharing.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
I think if we looked at, not the enthusiasts who are already on Twitter and all mm-hmm. the rest of it, a couple of sort of blockers to this process are something about Scottish people. There's a slight reluctance to put their heads above the parapet. Tall stalks get cut down.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's understandable, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the other one maybe is that there's some local authorities have funded themselves partly by selling resources to other local authorities.
Mm-hmm, Yes, I mean, that's problematic. I mean, I think you do have to question the benefit of that, where the benefit of those policies lie. And I think before you can start encouraging openness, you need to encourage a culture of sharing.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps too often education authorities have been encouraged to wall themselves off. And certainly once you get into the FE sector, to actively compete with each other.
Yeah.
And I think we really need to get past that, and we need more of a culture of sharing in all aspects of education, whether it's school sector or higher education, because there are still aspects of higher education that are very closed down. We need to foster this culture of sharing, and we need to make sure that people are talking to teachers and educators about sharing, about the importance of sharing and about the importance of openness. And to some extent, that actually goes right back to teacher training.
Mm-hmm.
And to continuous professional development and to the lifelong learning of teachers and educators ourselves. And certainly last week I was at the Open Coursework Consortium conference in Slovenia, And during the sort of opening plenary, one of the commissioners, the European commissioners, stated quite passionately and categorically that openness has to start with teacher training. And I think that was a very, very valid point to be made. I think we all need to think about what we can do to encourage that culture of sharing.
Sure. Personally, I think one of the things is not to worry too much about making mistakes.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yes. I mean, there's quite often there's a fear of openness. Yeah. I heard somebody once came up with a wonderful phrase of the agoraphobia of openness. Yeah. If you've been working in a very closed environment, to go completely open is quite frightening, really. It can be quite intimidating. And I think people will find all different kinds of excuses not to become open. I mean, I've done it myself. I mean, don't get me wrong. And you do need to overcome that fear. And I think, you know, becoming an open practitioner in the domain of teaching does take a bit of a leap of faith. But as you said, once you get out there, you generally find that the community is very, very supportive. There's a lot of like-minded people out there.
Yeah, and I think because they're all, to a certain extent, exposing themselves in the nicest possible way, obviously.
Yes.
They feel for you and will help you rather than stand on your toes or
Absolutely.
Your head to push you down. There's a few tweets come in, of course, which I've missed. First one by John Heffernan.
Mm-hmm.
John Mayo on Twitter, at John Mayo on Twitter, and he says, is EOR really supported by governments in the UK and further afield in education? Mm-hmm. And I think to some extent you've kind of addressed that by the history, but you might want to say a wee bit more about that.
Well, I mean, it's a good point. Governments is an interesting term. I would actually say not in the UK. I would say there's no direct government support for open education in the UK. You do get some support further down. Like I said, HEFCE did fund that big programme in England. There hasn't really been anything comparable in Scotland to date, though I believe the Scottish Funding Council has recently given the Open University some funding to look at the whole sort of open education space. And I'm involved in an initiative called Open Scotland, which is actually about promoting and raising awareness of open education, both to the schools and education sector, but also to the government sector. But you certainly do find some countries globally where the support comes from the very highest government level. And one of the reasons that the Open Courseware Consortium conference was in Slovenia was that the Slovenian government have just announced a national initiative to open access to education in Slovenia. And they want to become the first country in the European Union that has a truly open education system. And there are other countries in the Far East as well where openness is very, very much a government agenda. So Indonesia is another example.
Brilliant. Another tweet from Josie Fraser, who's probably well known to UK EdTech, and she said that they're working a project with Leicester City Council to raise awareness and understanding of OERs in schools.
Yep. Yes, great. And I think that's interesting as well, because one of the things that we're seeing from several countries is that there's a lot to be said for open education initiatives that work on a regional scale. I think sometimes the Slovenian example is quite interesting, because Slovenia is a very, very small country. It was quite interesting when I visited Ljubljana, because it's a beautiful city, but I thought, my, it's tiny. Yeah. And when I got back, I looked at the population, it's about the size of Aberdeen. Yeah. You know, so we're talking a small scale here, and sometimes it's much easier to get open education initiatives going on within a smaller community. So, for example, I think the work that the Josie and Leicester City Council are doing is a very, very good example of what you can do on a regional basis.
So maybe it's something that local authorities would take up in Scotland.
Absolutely.
By one rather than coming down from the government. And just the last tweet that I can see here comes from Jennifer Morak, And I think she's just pointing out, and people can look for the EduTalk hashtag, to a webinar series on OER and the Common Core, which I guess is more US-centric than over here, because we don't have a Common Core.
Yeah.
Our core is much less common, I think. So, obviously, a wee bit of interest out there in open ed, open educational resources, and in sort of how do we bring this in to school education. I think as well, part of the job I'm doing at the moment is with the GLOW project in Scotland.
Yes, yeah.
And GLOW has traditionally been everything behind a password, basically. And I think certainly from my own point of view, and other people I'm talking to, who are maybe not major decision makers, but hopefully are having some sort of influence, that we see it more that if it's a resource that's not protected by copyright in some way, or we can't expose widely, maybe we should be looking at, as a default position, exposing that. And then if there's going to be discussion or anything else that needs a login, then at that point you log in to maybe discuss the resource, because we're uneasy about children discussing something on the open web.
And there's a lot, I think, to be said for that position, and it's I know that it's a position that's often adopted to encourage more openness, the openness by default. So basically, all your content is open unless there is a good reason for it not to be. Where, of course, at the moment, what we have is more or less the other way around. You tend to keep everything closed unless you actually go to the effort of making it open. And I think, yes, that is ultimately where we would want to be. And I think also there's... I mean, I think we have reached the stage where, you know, publicly funded educational content should be made freely available to the public. You know, it should be there for learners.
Yeah,
and wherever they are.
If you're attached to an institution or not,
absolutely.
You define yourself as a learner because you're interested in learning.
Absolutely.
Would be a nice place to be.
Yes.
Then what needs to be behind the password, the reasons for it, maybe change and stuff like that would be interesting. You've touched upon Open Scotland a few times, and I'm not sure. I've been using two hashtags, Open Scot and Open Scotland, just in case, to try and pick up anything. Open Scotland.
Okay, Open Scotland is it's a purely voluntary, unfunded initiative, and it's also a cross-sector initiative. And it aims to raise awareness of open education and to encourage the sharing of open educational resources and explore the potential of open policy and practice to benefit all sectors of Scottish education. It's Open Scotland is facilitated by CETUS together with the Scottish Qualifications Authority, the JISC Regional Support Centre in Scotland, and the Association for Learning Technologies Scottish Special Interest Group. And one of the reasons why we came together to launch this initiative was many of us had been involved in open education initiatives elsewhere in the UK. And we wanted to bring some of that expertise to Scotland because we felt perhaps that there was much less awareness of open education right across the Scottish education sector than perhaps we find in England or in Wales, for example. So, as I said, we're a completely informal initiative. We have no funding at all for this. But we have run a number of events. We held what we called the Open Scotland Summit in Edinburgh last year, where we brought together representatives from a wide range of education bodies, including many from the school sector, from Education Scotland, from SQA, from SFC, to attend that event to discuss the potential of open education. We also run the Open Scotland blog, which is just openscot.net. And we have a hashtag, which is Open Scot, rather than Open Scotland. Keeps as brief as possible. And one of the other things that we've done is that we have drafted what we call the Scottish Open Education Declaration. Now, in my whistle-stop tour of open education history, I mentioned something called the UNESCO Paris OER Declaration. And what we've done is we've taken that declaration, which is very focused specifically on open educational resources, and we've broadened it so it refers to open education much more widely. And we've put it online using an open source tool called Comment Press. The whole thing is running on another open source platform called Domain of Our Own, which is run by your good friends Jim Groom and people like that. And we would encourage people to go and have a look at the Scottish Open Education Declaration and to comment on it, because it's an open public draft. We want everyone to look at it, to comment on it, to take it away, discuss it with their fellow teachers and with their students, and just contribute however they can. The declaration is not endorsed by the government in any way, shape or form. It would be great if one day it is, but if even it raises awareness of open education with a few more practitioners in the country, then hopefully that will have been valuable. And what I can do is when we finish this conversation, I'll tweet the link, in fact, to the Open Education Declaration. Yep. And to the Open Scotland blog. In fact, can I do that right now? Can I tweet and talk at the same time? Surely I must be able to do that by now.
I'm not great at that myself, I must admit. And it's even harder if somebody's talking to you at the same time. But we will put all these links, folks, while Lorna's typing. We'll have links on the post that has the archived audio, so there'll be links to Open Scotland Education Declaration, Open Scotland, which is openscot.net, and anything else that Lorna wants to pass our way. We'd be delighted to.
There you go. I've tweeted that at least. I probably got the hashtag wrong.
If people are listening, they just need to be quick. We'll get there, because it really just seems like a great chance to keep up with this stuff is just following that one blog.
I should also add, actually, that as I said, Open Scotland, it's a collaborative initiative right across the sector. The four organisations that I mentioned, we're the ones kind of pushing it along, but it's, you know, we want to engage as many people as possible, and we actively encourage other people to blog on the Open Scotland blog. So if, you know, anyone out there who is involved in anything that has any relevance to open education, then, you know, we would really welcome you to come and write a blog post for us. Or even if you want to question some of the assumptions made about open education, you know, we really want to be able to facilitate that debate. Or I don't know if there's anyone listening from out with Scotland. If you're involved in initiatives that you think might be of interest to people north of the border, then please do let us know. Because I think there's a lot that we can learn from the experiences of our colleagues all over the world. So please do get in touch if you would like to get something up there on the Open Scotland blog.
That's brilliant. And I think, obviously, a reasonable amount of our audience are people who are posting on Twitter or have blogs and things like that. And I suppose, in a way, as soon as you do that, you're joining in, I'll bet, Twitter is a commercial company, but you're joining in an open conversation.
Absolutely, definitely.
That sort of thing, I think, would be in line with being open. So even if people don't really think of themselves as open educators, if you've answered a tweet for help,
of course,
something in teaching and learning, you would be by definition an open educator.
Absolutely. And it's all about, it's like I said earlier, it's all about fostering that culture of sharing and, you know, overcoming the fear of open practice. And, you know, it's small steps, it takes time, but I think, you know, we can all get there, definitely.
This is probably veering off a wee bit, But one of the things you just brought it to mind is you said this Open ScotNet is mm-hmm. hosted on Reclaim Hosting, I believe.
Yes, that's right. Yep.
So mm-hmm. one of the principles behind Reclaim Hosting is that people own their own space.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the people who are interested in that, and there's a lot of different things. I've been reading a bit about IndieWeb and things like mm-hmm. that this week, mm-hmm. and various weird micro formats and enable automatic sharing and things that are far too hard for me. but what's quite interesting is that the people who are maybe attracted to openness are also quite attracted to identity,
mm-hmm.
and in owning their own space on the internet, say,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
not giving over to yes. silos. And I wondered if there's anything interesting.
Yeah, I definitely. I think, and again, I think one of the real benefits and beauties of open education is that you don't really need much to be able to do it.
Mm.
You don't need to have access to fancy software to be open. There are many, many ways you can be open. And it was interesting when we were involved with the UK Open Educational Resources Programme, CETUS had been advising JISC about the use of education technology for almost a decade by that point. It was part of our role to support JISC programmes. And what we used to do was we used to sort of say, okay, for this programme, the projects have to use institutional repositories, for example, or they've got to build a VLE, or they've got to use this particular standard or that particular application profile. We were quite prescriptive
mm-hmm.
about how technology was used. And that was successful to some degrees, but less so to other degrees. When it came to the UK OER programme, because it was a very experimental programme, we thought, right, we'll throw caution to the wind. And the technical guidelines for that programme said, use anything. Just get it out there. There was one code that was said, you must put a copy in the Joram National Repository. And that was kind of like the fail-safe. But we also said, put your resources somewhere else as well, and we don't care where it is. It can be your department website. It can be your own private blog. It can be a Facebook page, it can be anywhere. Just get stuff out there. We don't care how you do it, just get it out there. And I think that was a really interesting thing to do. And I think you're right, I think there is something about open practice and about the people who get involved in open education that they do have this tendency to find really interesting ways to get stuff out there. And that's certainly something that does interest me a great deal.
Yeah, I think I'm quite fascinated by the idea of you give stuff away for free, but you do it in your own way,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
you don't just hand it over to a large corporation, mm-hmm. of which there mm-hmm. are many targets mm-hmm. to deal with. As I say, mm-hmm. that's kind of straying off.
I think it's very relevant, and I should, I think I have to acknowledge that the reason that we're using Reclaim Hosting, that suggestion came from Martin Hoxie,
mm-hmm.
who some of you may know. Martin Hoxie used to work with Twitter. He now works with the CETUS. He now works with the Association of Learning Technologists, and it was Martin that suggested that we move from the sort of standard WordPress install to Reclaim Hosting. And you know, Martin's an interesting example of an open practitioner, I'm sure many of you will know him from Twitter. If you don't, I can highly recommend looking him up. When we were talking about MOOCs earlier on, the Association for Learning Technology runs its own MOOC called OCTEL, and that is running. It's OCTEL is the Open Course in Technology Enhanced Learning, and I do believe it's actually running at the moment, and it's running on an open platform that Martin built. It's not running on a commercial MOOC platform. It's on an open platform that is just, you know, there for other people to look at and use. So, you know, there's all different ways to do this. There's all different ways to become an open practitioner.
Brilliant. You maybe could pass us over, give me an email with that, the URL to Martin's set up, because I think that would be interesting.
Yeah.
Certainly to me, and I'm sure then to lots of other people. Lorna, I'm conscious that I said that I'd keep you half an hour and we're heading towards here.
It's not a problem.
And that's your fault for being interesting. It's one of the disadvantages of being open is that people take advantage of you. I need to talk for ages, but I mean, I've been just fascinated and encouraged, and it's nice to get a really good overview of something that I am sort of signed up to emotionally without any real depth of knowledge and understanding, and I think that's certainly helped me an awful lot tonight. Is there anything else you want to mention before we wrap it up?
I don't think so. I think we've more or less covered everything, but it seems that we sort of rambled over a lot of territory. I mean, just really, I think, you know, I would encourage people, you know, to please do engage with what Open Scotland is trying to do, and, you know, just to think about sharing and openness in their own practice, and just, you know, just try and raise awareness in what you're doing about, you know, all aspects of openness in education.
Yeah, and I think if anybody who is in education, and this came up to me very forcefully today, that nearly everybody who anything they've done that's any use, they've learned it from somebody else, sharing it with them, sharing the idea with them. If you look at what you do, if you're in education, you probably are sharing things. And this is a rather horrible quote. Somebody once said to me, it's like, if you're not willing to share with other people, why are you sharing with those 33 poor kids every day?
Yes.
If it's good enough for them, it should be good enough for the rest of us.
Absolutely,
so,
absolutely. Well, it's what education is about, isn't it? It's about sharing.
And maybe if we just look and see what we already are sharing, that we'll find out that it's not that scary. So just, I'll say a huge thanks to you, Lorna. I think there's lots for everybody to engage with here.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me along to speak. Now, I've really enjoyed it. I'm always delighted to talk about this subject. And, you know, like I say, if anyone wants to pick up on any of the points that I've mentioned tonight, you know, do please feel free to get in touch either via my email address, which I'm quite happy for that to be circulated, or come and find me on Twitter. Like I say, I'm very happy to talk. So thank you very much for inviting me along tonight. It's been great.
Delightful. And just for people listening, tomorrow night David will be back with the Professional Learner for Teachers channel, and I'm going to mispronounce this, Professor Paul Krishner, who's from the Western Institute Open University Netherlands, who's going to be talking about urban legends in education. What does good science say? We'll be back next Wednesday, and I think David's putting these names up just to get me, for Dr. Oskaya from the University of Leicester. I'm really sorry for murdering your name. About research into Huntington's disease. And for the rest of May, we have a pretty full programme, Wednesdays and Thursdays, going on into June. So if you find this interesting, you will probably find something else interesting. I'd say thanks for listening. Get in touch with either David or myself by tweeting at edutalker or hashtagging edutalk, or drop us a line on the email. So I'm just going to say thank you very much again to Lorna, and good night to everybody. Cheers.